For the kind invitation to visit the Perimeter Institute and the opportunity to present my work here. So the stories that I will be telling you about is a very unconventional quantum criticality, where the two well-known types of quantum criticality, symmetry breaking and confinement, seem to coincide in a single critical point, which gives rise to an emergent, an enlarged global and local symmetries. Before I begin, I would like to thank my collaborators, Fakir Asad from the University of Wurzburg and the Harvard gang, Subir Sachdev, Ashwin Vishwanath, and Chong Wing. Okay, so before I discuss unconventional quantum critical point, let me just very quickly review what I refer to when I say a conventional quantum critical point. So as I'm sure you all know very well, so in many cases of interest, one can study quantum criticality using the classical theory of symmetry breaking a la Landau, with the key importance difference that one also needs to take into account temporal or quantum fluctuation to do the quantum to classical mapping, and one considered a system with an enlarged dimension, which here I denote by capital D. So maybe the simplest example where this physics arises is the quantum version of the Ising model, or the transit field Ising model. The Hamiltonian here consists out of two terms. The first term is a classical nearest neighbor Ising interaction, which tends to align the spin to point in the same direction, and a competing transverse field term, which generates quantum fluctuations. So if we want to do a Landau-like analysis, we still first need to figure out what are the symmetries of the model. And it's easy to see that it has a global Z2 spin flip symmetries. And the two terms here would compete and will lead to a zero temperature quantum phase transition, where if we first consider the limiting case where the Ising interaction dominates, the Z2 symmetry would be broken and we'll get a ferromagnetic state, where here I've quite arbitrarily chosen the spin to point upwards. Once we increase the strength of the transverse field term, quantum fluctuations would disorder the ferromagnetic state and restore the symmetry in the paramagnetic state. Now, the key object in Landau's theory is the order parameter, which is used to characterize both phases, and maybe even more importantly, to describe the critical fluctuations near the quantum critical point. And for the Ising model, the order parameter is simply the magnetization, which is, of course, finite in the ferromagnetic phase and vanishes as we go to the paramagnetic phase. So luckily, in the recent years, we've seen an increasing number of examples of physical systems which do not fit into this familiar Landau description. So just to give an example, which will be relevant for later discussion, let me try to show you a model which displays quantum criticality without any symmetry breaking. So what we consider is some modification of the well-known Torrey code model. So the Torrey code is an Ising-like model, where instead of placing the spins on the side, we place them on the bonds. And the Hamiltonian has two terms, a star term, which equals the product over the sigma x operator that emanate from each one of the vertices, and a plaquette term, which equals to the product of the sigma z operators belonging to each one of the plaquettes. So now what I'll do, I'll add a mixed field term, one in the transverse direction and one in the longitudinal direction. And the purpose of those terms is essentially to break all the global symmetries of the model. So if I introduce those two terms, now the model has no global symmetries. So if we follow Landau's analysis, we expect to see no phase transitions in the model. But if one actually compute the phase diagram, and this can be done using quantum Monte Carlo. And here I'm plotting the phase diagram as a function of the two fields, Hx and Hz. One actually finds three distinct phases and an actual quantum phase transition that separates them. So this definitely goes beyond Landau theory because we have a phase transition in the model without any symmetries. So what's going on? It turns out that in order to understand the nature of this phase transition, one needs to invoke an emergent topological order description with a gate theory structure. And the transition here is a Higgs or confinement transition. And I will make this more clear later on. So another important class of problems which go beyond Landau theory are known as deconfined criticality. So in such cases, a direct and a continuous transition can be realized between two symmetry incompatible phases in two-dimensional spin half lattice models. And more concretely, a transition between an anti-ferromagnetic state which breaks the SE2 spin rotational symmetry and a valence bond solid or VBS which breaks the point group symmetry. So while one can describe both phases using an order parameter, we can ascribe an order parameter to each phases, one runs into trouble in trying to describe a continuous transition here, because if we follow Landau theory, the competition between the two order parameters without any fine-tuning will lead to either a first-order phase transition or a split transition where one of the symmetries precedes the other. So it turns out that in order to properly describe the properties of this phase transition, one again needs to invoke an emergent gauge theory description, and the critical modes here are not described by a conventional order parameter, by deconfined excitations of a gauge theory. So what I'll show you today is again a direct and a continuous transition between two types of orders, but it won't be between two types of broken symmetries. It would be between a broken symmetry phase and a topological ordered phase. So more concretely, we'll try to analyze the following phase diagram, a continuous transition between an anti-ferromagnetic state, which breaks spin rotational symmetry, and a topological phase with Dirac fermions and a deconfined Ising gate theory. So it turns out that one, if one tries to, again, carry out a Landau-like description of the phase transition without fine-tuning, again, we expect to see either a first-order phase transition or a split transition where the breaking of the symmetry precedes confinement. And the purpose of this work is trying to analyze the nature of this phase transition and write down a critical field theory and test it in numerical simulations. Okay, so the outline would be roughly as follows. First I'll give a very short review to the physics of the Ising gate theory in 2+1 dimensions. Then I'll present our model where we couple the Ising gate theory to fermions and explain how we can avoid the numerical sign problem, which would enable us to carry out an unbiased numerical calculation and fully determine the phase diagram. And then I'll present our numerical result and our conjectured critical theory. And I'll conclude with some open questions and a summary. Okay, so feel free to ask me questions as I go along if something is unclear. Okay, so let's start with the first topic. So the Ising lattice gate theory is maybe the simplest example of a gate theory. And despite its simplicity, it exhibits a highly non-trivial phase diagram. So just to be more concrete, let me consider a square lattice model. And as with the toric code, I'm placing as a degrees of freedom, I'm placing Ising spins on the bonds. And the Hamiltonian consists, again, out of two terms that we already encountered, Plaquette term and a transverse field term. And just to make the analogy to electromagnetism more apparent, I can construct the following dictionary, where I identify the sigma z operators with the electromagnetic gauge field and the sigma x operator with the electric field. And of course, unlike electromagnetism, where those fields are continuous, here there will be binary variables that can either take the values 0 or pi. So we can also construct another gauge invariant quantity corresponding to the magnetic flux that threads each one of the plaquettes. So as with the gauge field and the electric field, this would be a binary variable, which can either be 0 or pi. Now, what makes this theory into a gauge theory is the presence of an infinite number of local symmetries, okay, Ising symmetries, which are generated by this gauge transformation, which inevitably leads to an infinite number of conserved quantities, which are essentially the eigenvalues QR of the generator of the Ising local Ising transformation. And the physical meaning of those eigenvalues is essentially they correspond to our choice of background static charge configurations that we can place at each site. So in order to make this gauge theory well-defined, we need to make such a choice, okay? And the easiest choice is just to say there are no charges at all, and this would lead to an Ising version of Gauss's law, which more picturally means that states for which the parity of the product of the sigma x operators is even belong to the physical Hilbert space, and when the parity is odd, they're outside of the physical Hilbert space. And now, once we introduce a Matterfield, we place Ising charges at the sites, we need to modify Ising Gauss law in order to take into account the presence of those Matterfields, since they are sources for the electric field. So now, instead of having an even parity for the sigma x operators, we would have to have an odd parity in order to stay within the physical Hilbert space. Okay, so now that we know the rules of the game of the Ising gauge theory, let us briefly remind ourselves what's the zero temperature phase diagram of the model. So the two terms here would compete and would lead to a zero temperature quantum phase transition. So first, let's look at the limiting case where the transverse field term dominates. So here, the ground state would be a state where all the spin points in the positive x direction. So I call this phase a confining phase. And the reason for that is that let's suppose that we introduce two external test charges positioned in some distance L, one from the other. Then the only way to comply with Ising Gauss's law is to connect them with a string of flip spins. And the energy cost of each flip spin is roughly 2L. Such that the energy cost of the total spin would grow linearly with the separation of those two charges. And this, of course, leads to confinement because one cannot infinitely separate the two charges, one from the other. But now, as we increase the strength of the flux terms, the string tension here would drop to zero, and we would move to what I call a deconfined phase, where those charges will be liberated. And the ground state here would be an eigenstate in the flux and not in the electric field. And more specifically, to minimize the flux energy, we will have to place a zero flux through each one of those plaquettes. So now if we look at excitations above this ground state, they correspond to a single spin flip, okay, which would generate two pi fluxes, which are also known as vital. Now, the crucial point here is that the phase transition here does not involve any pattern of symmetry breaking. And the way to distinguish the two phases is by the emergence of topological order in the deconfined phase, which is manifest is in ground state, fourfold ground state degeneracy on a torus, and fraction under excitation, which actually we see two of them here, the Vison, which is known as the M particle, and the electric charge, and there's also a bound state of the two, which forms a fermion, but that would not be crucial for our discussion. So another interesting comment here, that if we want to understand the critical properties of the confinement to deconfinement transition here, there's actually a very nice mapping of the two-dimensional Ising gauge theory to the three-dimensional classical Ising model, such that also the critical property or the universality class will be shared between the two models. And the two vanishing energy scale would be the string tension, which drops to zero as we go from the confined phase to the deconfined phase, and the Vison gap, which vanishes as we go from the deconfined phase to the confined phase. Okay, so now that we hopefully understand the physics of the pure Ising gauge theory, let's try to couple it to fermions and see what phases can we achieve. So we consider the following model. As before, we have a square lattice model, and the Ising gauge field live on the bonds. And now we can introduce a fermionic manifold. We'll consider a spinful manifold. The alpha index here corresponds to the spin index. And the fermions can hop between the lattice sites. And for the Hamiltonian, for the Ising gauge zero sector, we take the usual Hamiltonian. And for the fermions, we consider a nearest neighbor hopping term, which in order to make sure that it is gauge invariant, we need to introduce Ising version of the Paris substitution, which physically means that the sign of the hopping amplitude depends on the Ising gauge field along the corresponding bond. And we'll also introduce on-site Hubbard interaction, although they would not change the universal properties of the specific transition we'll be interested in. They will allow us to draw a slightly more generic phase diagram and contrast our result with other type of more conventional phase transition. Okay, so now I would like to add an important comment. So even though I call this F operator fermion, it's not actually a physical fermion because it also carries a gauge charge. And following the work of this gentleman, we call them orthogonal fermions.
Is there a chemical potential for the fermions?
So, okay, so in principle, you can actually add a chemical potential. And actually, in terms of the numerics, it still remains sign problem free. And I refer you to this work where we study this. The focus of this work would be at the half-field case. So I'm not introducing an extra chemical potential. Okay? Answer to your question?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
So the only coupling is the first term at HF.
So the only coupling here. So not entirely, because as I'll show later, you also need to satisfy an Ising-Gauss law. Okay, so...
ends aren't related to the Ising A's you had earlier.
Again?
The ends are independent of the sigmas.
The ends are independent of the sigma. Yes, but... I don't fully understand the question.
You said you have to understand.
They're related by the Gauss law.
The Gauss law. So yeah, the annoying thing about writing the Hamiltonian version of gauge theories is that it doesn't explicitly include Gauss's law. So only when you write this as a path integral, then you explicitly project it to the physical hyperspace. So actually, as I will in a few slides I'll show, actually it plays a very essential role. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So maybe if it's not clear in a few slides, just ask me again. Okay. Okay, so I think it's important to see how we can start from a more physical model of fermions which do not carry any gate charge and propagate to our orthogonal fermions. So the way that it's done is by choosing maybe the simplest way to fractionalize an electron, and this is done by the following problem. So we start by denote by C as true fermion, okay, which we have in a metal or something like that. And the fractionalization pattern that I choose is a product of an F fermion times an Ising particle, okay? So this very, you can easily see that this introduces an Ising gauge redundancy because I can multiply both operators by a minus sign, and this would not change any physical operators. Okay, the C electrons remains the same. So the orthogonal fermion here, in terms of global symmetry, carries both the SU2 spin index and the U1 electromagnetic charge, and that's very different from the usual fractionalization pattern to a holon and spinon, where the spinon or the F electron only carries the SU2 spin. Okay, that's a fundamental difference. And the Ising butterfly or the tau, they only carry energy. And in the analysis that I'll show today, they will soon to be gapped throughout. Okay, they will not play any role. Okay. So now, okay, even though it would not be a Landau theorem, we still need to figure out what are the symmetries of the model. That's still a requirement to analyze the system. So let's see what are the system, and again, we focus only on half filling. So first, we have an SU2 symmetry corresponding to spin rotations, okay? And at half filling, if we combine a particle symmetry with the U1 symmetry corresponding to particle number conservation, we get an enlarged SU2 symmetry also in the charge sector, okay? You can define the corresponding operator, but the physics of this pseudo-spin symmetry is that it essentially rotates between a charge density order and S-wave pairing, okay? And as before, also we have local gate symmetries, and they're pretty similar to the pure Ising gate theory case, with the important difference that now we need to take into account the presence of dynamical matter fields. This might answer your question. So the Ising gate theory is only sensitive to the parity of the fermions, and not to the fermion number as in electromagnetism. And as before, we need to pick a static charge assignment in order to properly define the gate theory. So for a uniform static charge configuration, we essentially have two choices, which are known as an even and an odd lattice gate theory. So let's see how it goes. So the even case is slightly simpler. It just means that we have no static background charges. And in the deconfined phase, where we want to expel out all the electric charges, this would favor even occupancy because we would like to put in gauge neutral object, which are either a holon or a doublon. On the other hand, for the odd lattice gate theory, when we place a single background Ising charge at each site, here in the confining phase, we would like to have an odd occupancy, meaning that we put a single electron at each side, and together with the background static charge, it would form a gauge neutral object, okay? And now it turns out that one can actually map between the two theories using a partial particle Hoehn transformation, which for example, acts only on the spin down or the spin up fermion. So under this transformation, it's very easy to show that the even and the odd lattice gates here are mapped one to the other. The sign of the Hubbard interaction is flipped. And the two symmetries are interchangeable. That's very easy to see because under partial particle transformation, the SZ operator is mapped to the density operator and vice versa. Okay, so anti-ferromagnetism would be mapped to a degenerate S-wave pairing and a charge density wave. Okay? Okay, so now that we defined the model and found the symmetry, let's see how those two phases, the confined and the deconfined phase, are realized in a system with fermions. So first, let's understand how the confining phase looks like. So deep in the confining phase, any fractionalized object or objects which are not gauge neutral are very expensive. And as I've shown before, for an odd lattice gauge theory, this forces placing exactly one fermion per side. So here you can see the importance of the Ising-Gauss law. Okay, even though I don't write it explicitly in the Hamiltonian, it actually forces the field. Okay, and essentially here we eliminated all the charge degree of freedom, and we are left only with the only dynamical degree of freedom is the spin of the electron. And now, once we allow some quantum fluctuations, the spins would interact through a super exchange mechanism. And at zero temperature, we expect to see AFM order. Okay, so the confining phase is expected to essentially exhibit an anti-ferromagnetic order. So now let's see what's happening in the deconfined phase. Okay, so in the deconfined phase, the fermions are free. They can move around. And the only thing we need to determine is the band structure, okay? And the band structure is determined by the flux pattern that we impose on the lattice, okay? And so the particular choice that we'll have here is to take the coupling constant J to be negative. Just to remind you, the coupling constant J stands in front of the flux term, okay? So this means that in the deconfined phase, where the flux term dominates, we'll have we spontaneously generate a pi flux through each one of those plaquettes. Okay. So now, if you solve the band structure of fermions that hop in the background of the pi flux, you see that you get Dirac fermions. Okay. And so the spectrum would contain two Dirac nodes and slightly modifying the term coined by the gentleman before, we'll call this phase an orthogonal semi-mesh. Okay? So now we can roughly understand the structure of the phase diagram in the two limiting cases, in order to investigate the phase transition between two phases, we need to, unfortunately, resort to numerical simulations, since it's a very strongly coupled system. And we'll be using quantum Monte Carlo method. So just to keep the technical discussion pretty concise, I'd like to just mention two important facts about the quantum Monte Carlo simulation in this specific problem. So actually, the first issue is how do we enforce Gauss's law? Okay. So usually, the partition function is just a trace or the thermal partition function, but here we need to introduce a projection operator, which would project to the physical Hilbert space comprising states that obey Ising-Gauss's law. So this can be done by resolving the projector using a discrete Lagrange multiplier, which then allows us to perform the usual quantum to classical mapping and map the problem to a classical problem in one higher dimension. So what's the physical meaning of those Lagrange multipliers? They turn out, if I'm plotting here a space-time diagram, the physical meaning is that essentially they are the temporal component of the gauge field, which allows us to, by statistically sampling them, to exactly enforce the constraint of the Ising-Gauss law. So this is not enough because, as I'm sure you might have heard, fermions are kind of tricky in the Monte Carlo setting because the fermion determinant here is not necessarily positive. And this could lead to what is known as the sign problem, where the Boltzmann weights are not really classical because they can be either negative or positive. Luckily here, and the key observation here is that whenever the representation of the gate theory is a real representation, okay, then once we trace over the gate field, the Fermi determinant must also be real. Okay? And then if we have an even number of flavors, and in our case we have two flavors, spin up and spin down, then the determinant would square to at least a non-negative non-negative value, and we get rid of the numerical sign problem. Okay? Okay, so now that we solved the sign problem, we're ready to construct the phase diagram of the model. And yes, of course.
My understanding was that also the not only it could be negative, but it could even be complex.
You're right. And that's related to the question about the chemical potential. Okay, so actually it's half filling. You can use particle symmetry, okay, to essentially eliminate the sign problem even for lattice QCD. Okay, there's no sign problem. Once you go away from half filling, then you necessarily introduce, due to the chemical rotation, you introduce a sign problem because the determinant would be complex. Okay, so I'm not going to talk about this today. I can refer you to a previous publication. But the nice thing about the Ising-Gate theory is that even at a finite density of fermions, as you go away from half filling, there is no sign problem because the representation of the group is real. Okay, so you can actually simulate this theory away from half filling. Okay? It turns out to be slightly less interesting in terms of the physics, but you can do it. Okay?
Just to be clear, G inverse is the
propagator.
Is the propagator in the for configuration of your sigmas.
Yeah.
In the presence of the Lagrange multiplier.
Yeah. Okay. Yes, exactly. So as an algorithm, it's called a determinant at Monte Carlo.
Right.
So essentially, you know, you cannot put Grassmann variables in the computer. So you either do some kind of a Hubbard-Sutton-Whitney. We don't need to do Hubbard-Sutton-Whitney because we have a bosonic, you know, bosonic field, and you can trace over the fermions and you get a determinant. And you know, it's a pain to compute the determinant, but you can do this in the computer, and you do it. And indeed, you can identify in terms of, you know, if you want to do analysis, you can identify this as the propagator for a given gate field configuration. Okay, and by the way, it's okay. I'm not going to discuss those techniques, but it's kind of a miracle that even when you put the constraint here, you don't generate a sign problem. In many cases, just putting the constraint generates a sign problem. Okay, so it's a lot of algebra, and I won't be able to explain this. But you know, it's you'd have to trust me that there's no sign problem. Yes.
What happened to the Hubbard U?
Yeah. So the slides here are not complete. So for the Hubbard U, what you do a Hubbard-Sutton-Whitney transformation, and then you get another bosonic field. So yeah. So there's an extra 100 lines of the code which take care of the additional Hubbard-Sutton-Whitney fields, which also fluctuates. Okay. Okay, but that's slightly more standard. That's what's done routinely in Hubbard model simulation. Okay, any more questions?
So you have also transverse field U-tuning, or
a transverse field,
yeah,
for the gate. So all of this is here. So this is your bosonic action.
There's some external fields. There's some H. There's some couplings in there, like
a. Yeah, but essentially. When I write here SB, this is the quantum to classical mapping of the Ising-Gate theory. You just get a three-dimensional plaquette model that, yes, exactly, precisely. That's the standard thing. Okay. So essentially, you have So all of the simulations are essentially the same. You have some bosonic degrees of freedom, okay, and they interact with the fermionic determinant. Okay.
So how does lambda enter, like, so you have, if you had no fermions?
Yes. How would lambda enter?
Yeah, how does lambda enter into
the
just hard to move on.
Yeah, of course. Okay, so if you start from an Eisengate theory, so this would be space and time. Okay, so you have a classical action associated with each one of the plaquettes, which is essentially J times product over sigma Z of each one of the plaquettes. But once you do the quantum to classical mapping, you would get space-time plaquettes. Okay, and the lambdas are the component, the temporal component of the gauge field. So to get lambda, lambda, sigma z, where this is a tau plus one here. This is sigma z at tau. And the temporal component comes here. So this is where the lambda comes in.
That adds on to H, because the H also enters that way too, right?
H, you mean
the transverse field also?
Yes, there's it's really nice. If you do algebras, there's a magic.
Say again?
There's a kind of a magic, and essentially the coupling constant that sits here depends on the transverse field H, okay? Okay, so let's move on. So now we need to define some observables in order to detect the different phases in the numerics. So first, how do we detect more standard symmetry breaking order? We can look at the spin susceptibility. And I'm defining here a slightly convoluted observable, but I promise you it's useful. And it's essentially the ratio between the spin susceptibility slightly detuned from the Bragg vector divided by the spin susceptibility exactly at the Bragg vector. And the only thing you need to remember from this long discussion is that in the disordered phase, we expect to see a roughly flat momentum dependence. So lambda would tend to zero. And in the ordered phase, we expect to see a pronounced response at the Bragg factor, and lambda would tend to one. Okay, that's the only thing you need to remember. It's sort of a dimensionless order parameter. Now, for confinement, stuff get more difficult. It turns out that in the presence of matter field, it's very difficult to sharply define what confinement is. The only way that I know of is through the topological correction to the entanglement entropy, which unfortunately, although feasible, it's highly difficult to do in quantum Monte Carlo simulations. And we pick a far more modest observable, which is essentially like the specific heat in classical phase transition, which essentially look at the susceptibility of the Ising flux, which expected to develop some singularity at the confinement transition. Okay? Okay. So now let's look at the numerical results.
Okay, but that guy is it's non-zero in both phases, right? It's not away.
Okay. Yeah, it's not okay, so okay, so usually what people use to define as the order parameter, you can write a Wilson loop.
Right.
And what people really like using is called a Polyakov loop, which is essentially a loop just along the imaginary time axis. So for a pure lattice gate series, that's a well-defined order parameter, which essentially physically tells you what is the free energy difference between putting an extra charge to the system. And of course, in the confining phase, this is very expensive. So you actually, it's an honest-to-God order parameter. The problem is that once you have matter fields, what happens, you can have charge screening. So let's say you put an extra charge, you just put another fermion on top of it, and that's it. It's neutral. So you don't detect a singularity in that way in the terms of an order parameter. Mm-hmm. Okay? And yeah. So I've searched the lattice QCD literature very extensively. That's also a problem for them, and they've been trying to solve this for many years. I didn't come up with a solution. So, okay, but for us, I'll show you that this observable actually very nicely detects the confinement transition. Okay. Okay. So essentially, this summarizes all of our results, and essentially, this is the phase diagram of our model. As the axis here is the transverse field term, which takes us from a confining phase to a deconfining phase, and the on-site Hubbard U. Okay, so we have three phases. First, for large values of H, we're in a confining phase, which is characterized by the rise of anti-ferromagnetic order. If we now move to the deconfined phase on the background of the pi flux, we have here the Dirac fermions coupled to a deconfined Ising gate theory. And the last phase, which I did not mention, is an AFM star phase, which arises as we increase the strength of the on-site Hubbard interactions. Eventually, we will gap up the fermions and form an anti-ferromagnet, but it's a special ferromagnet. It has a star, okay? And the key difference between the AFM star phase and the AFM is that the Ising gate theory is deconfined here, and here it's confined, okay? And if you remember at the beginning, I said that, you know, that this direct transition is actually not generic, and that's true, because I can pick a trajectory in parameter space which goes like this. So it means that first we break the symmetry, and only then we confine. Okay, so a direct transition is actually not a generic case, okay? Okay, so now let's look at the different phase transitions here. So first, let's move from the orthogonal semi-metal to the AFM star phase as a function of the on-site Hubbard U. So here I'm plotting lambda AFM, which is a function of U for different system sizes. So indeed, we see that for large U, this tends to unity, which means that we have an anti-ferromagnetic order. And being a dimensionless variable, or you know, CFT language, zero scaling dimension, curves corresponding to different space-time volumes should cross at the phase transition if it's second order. And indeed, we see here the onset of anti-ferromagnetic order. On the other hand, here I'm plotting the flux susceptibility. We just cross it smoothly. There's no appreciable feature here. So we can conclude that we have anti-ferromagnetic order without confinement. So both phases are deconfined. The only difference is the emergence of symmetry breaking. So now let's move to the transition between the AFM star and the AFM phase. Okay. So here we expect to see only a confinement transition. So lambda AFM crosses smoothly. It's almost one. Okay, the axis here is not very good. So there's AFM order throughout. But the flux susceptibility develops a peak at the phase transition. This is, you should, in terms of a classical phase transition, you should think of this as a specific heat that's diverging. So we can see that we have confinement here without any symmetry breaking. Now to the most interesting case, or the orthogonal semi-metal confinement transition. So here, hopefully, we'll get both symmetry breaking and confinement. Okay, and indeed, we see that we get a curve crossing for lambda FM, which marks the onset of anti-ferromagnetic order. And alongside with it, we get a divergence of the flux susceptibility right at the same point. So this means that symmetry breaking and confinement coincide without any fine tuning. Okay?
And you find that surprising?
Yes, because usually if there's another way,
right,
the system would pick it, you know.
Right.
If you can do something like this, yeah, which is way simpler without any fine tuning of parameters, why won't you do something like this?
So why is it the case?
Okay, that's the next slide. Okay, so so let's try to build a field theoretical description of this condition. Okay, so the story goes as follows. So the first step is to embed the Ising-gate theory in a larger gauge group, an SU2 gauge group. And then, in order to realize both phases, we introduce a 3x3 matrix Higgs field, which transformed as spin 1 in the adjoint representation under the symmetry action of the SU2 gauge group. So now let's see how we can obtain both phases. So when the Higgs field is condensed, okay, so the gauge symmetry is reduced down to Z2, and we obtain the orthogonal semi-metal. Okay, and when the expectation value of the Higgs field vanishes, okay, the low and we can, you know, it's gap, we can integrate it out. So the low energy physics is an SE2 gauge field coupled to two component Dirac fermions and two flavors of Dirac fermions. And the latest lattice QCD simulations have found that this system automatically confines with chiral symmetry baking. And in our case, this corresponds to anti-ferromagnetic order. So we can drive the transition using a single tuning parameter corresponding to the mass of the Higgs field. Okay. So now we can group together all of the degrees of freedom and try to write down a critical field theory.
So your Higgs field, is that the anti-ferromagnetic order parameter? Is that the Nyel order parameter?
Okay, so I have a slide for that. I wasn't planning on in this, but so actually, in the paper we present two ways to construct the Higgs field from the physical degree of freedom. I'll present one of them. So the way to do that is as follows. So you can group all the fermions into 2x2 matrix. Okay, the only true symmetries of the model are the two global symmetries, which are the SE2 spin and the SE2 charge. And you can express both of them using this matrix. Okay, you can do the algebra, it works. And now the Higgs field is introduced by replacing the Pauli matrix here by this triad. Okay, this further introduces an SU2 symmetry because you can easily convince it if you multiply by U dagger here and X by U. Then this object remains invariant. And you can see that H transforms the adjoint representation, spin one, okay? And this essentially fits the description, okay? And when the Higgs field condenses, you get the same physics. So there's an alternative way to do that using starting from physical fermions, but I don't have the slide. Okay. Okay, so we can...
Can you go back one slide? You said you have the Higgs as a spin one. However, the expectation value we were showing us was delta AB. So I'm saying a 3x3 matrix, the spin one part of a 3x3 matrix is the anti-symmetric part.
The Higgs field has both left multiplication as the Higgs and the right multiplication.
Yeah, it's slightly more. It's
a little more complicated.
Okay, it's a little bit more complicated. So it also transforms under the global symmetries using left multiplication.
So it's a matrix in this sense. It's by triplet.
Exactly. Yeah. By triplet.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
So you can try to assemble together all the degrees of freedom, which is our SE2 gate theory coupled to two flavors of Dirac fermion and a near critical Higgs field. Now, this theory has a non-trivial prediction about the critical point, which is that we'll have an emergent SO5 symmetry, which rotates between AFM order and valence bond solid order. Okay, so let's see this more explicitly. So one can define the lattice definitions of those order parameter and stack them up in a super vector, five component super vector. And in the presence of SO5 symmetry, we expect it to transform as a vector under the SO5 symmetry action. Okay. And okay, so let's see how it goes. So first, we actually need to see that we get U1 symmetry here because the VBS actually microscopically has only C4 symmetry to the lattice. And indeed, we see that we get an emergent rotational inverse. This is the joint probability distribution from the numerics. And next, we need to see if we have a U1 component between those two order parameters. And quite remarkably, indeed, if you plot the joint probability distribution of those two order parameters, you see an emergent circular symmetry at criticality. Okay? So now let's try to make this slightly more quantitative. In order to do that, we can define the following susceptibility ratios between the VBS fluctuations and the AFM fluctuations. So in the presence of an SO5 symmetry, we expect the scaling dimensions of those two operators to coincide. And this means that at the critical point, they must cross. And indeed, this is the case. Okay, so we see it, and actually they cross exactly at the value of the critical point that I derived using other observables here. And this gives a very strong indication for the presence of an SO5 symmetry. And it's also very instructive to contrast this with the more usual Gross-Navot-Yukawa transition, just the AFM ordering, where no crossing is seen. Okay? So this is a qualitatively distincting fixture, okay, which tells us that you know this putative critical point must belong to a completely different universality class. Okay? And okay, this finally motivates us to perform some critical finite size scaling analysis to extract some critical data. And this is done in the usual way in using finite size scaling. So first, we'll consider the two universal amplitudes I defined before, one for the AFM order and for the VBS order. It's very convenient because you only need a single, since they have a zero scaling dimension, you only need a single critical exponent to fit, and we can fit both of them using the following correlation as exponent. And we can also extract the anomalous dimension, which importantly has to coincide between the, has to agree if you use either the AFM order or the VBS order due to the SO5 symmetry, and we get a pretty decent curve collapse, and we can extract the anomalous exponent from this analysis. Okay, so before I conclude, let me just state a few open questions. So first, it would be very nice to find maybe more direct signatures of this emergent gate theory and the Higgs field and test this in the numerics. Admittedly, we use lattices which are much smaller than the bosonic counterpart of deconfined criticality. So it would be very nice to look at larger lattices and rule out the possibility of a weak first-order phase transition. Okay, this would require some technical breakthrough, and which might be linked to the following observation that actually our model is purely bosonic. There are no gauge-neutral fermions in the model, so there must be somewhere in the land of models a purely bosonic realization of the model, and it would be very nice to find one and simulate on larger lattices. And one other direction that we're pushing now is models where you actually put a physical fermion into the play, which can lead to very interesting phases. So, okay, I'll just leave this summary slide and for questions. Yeah.
Who's that one? Do you understand?
Haven't thought about this, but it's you think about instead of writing a critical fit theory for it? Yeah, I haven't thought about it.
It's presumably this QCD plus some Yukawa,
some critical
Yukawa or something.
So what do you mean by signatures of emergent gauge theories? Because often, you know, there's descriptions without not involving gauge fields at all, the same theories.
So for instance, one signature is that if you correct me if I'm mistaken, if you break time versus symmetry, you should get interesting anionic excitations in the system, which are related to the emergent NCT symmetry. Of course, if you break time versus symmetry, you cannot simulate this using quantum Monte Carlo, but okay, so those are technical problems that we leave to the future.
The field theory you just wrote down in the previous slide is something that you conjectured based on your numerics, or you can derive it from first principles?
It's a conjecture. I don't think you can start from the physical model and you know.
Can't you do it with your classical to quantum to classical mapping and try to get it from?
No.
What prevents you from doing that?
Formally, you can do it.
Yeah, okay.
Well, it's maybe another really common one you make. So you mentioned this SO5 symmetry as an emergent symmetry, and that's true. It's really an approximate symmetry, and only at the other point does it become exact. On the other hand, the SU2 gauge invariance is always exact. It's just another formulation of the theory.
Yeah.
You may, it's optional whether you want to use it or not. You can really treat it as a SE2 gauge theory or SU2 gauge theory. It's just a matter of choice. But the SU2 gauge theory offers a way of analytically understanding the critical point and the exponents in principle.
Yeah.
That's the only reason you would choose it, but it's always exact.
Can you say again this SO5 symmetry? I mean, does it come out as an emergent symmetry from the Higgs model that you have for the critical point, for the critical theory, or not? Well,
there are two SO5 fixed points here. So even if you look at the free Dirac fermion in the background of the pi flux, it also has an SO5 symmetry. Nakai and Ho. Okay, but the two fixed points are different. So one of them is a strongly coupled one, okay, where you couple this to the emergent gauge field and the critical Higgs field, and the other one is sort of a free one. Okay, so it's I don't know if it answers your question. So if you look at the so if you go to the left of this, you would eventually flow to the free Dirac fermion, and also over there, all the curve would coincide, single curve. So there are two SO5 symmetries. One is free, and this one is another one with a non-trivial physics associated, strongly coupled fixed.
Yeah, but my question is, so in terms of the symmetries of the Higgs theory you wrote down...
The Higgs is a symmetric other SO5.
Well, I think I answered that differently.
Okay.
If you just take free Dirac fermion, two flavors of free Dirac fermions, on, that has an SO8 symmetry. That's right.
Yes, okay.
The fermions, it's SO8. Okay. So now you gauge the SO3 part of the SO8. That's the SU2 gauge theory. So
you're left with SO5.
Is important. What's left over is SO5. So that's why the measurement of SO5 is evidence for the SU2 gauge field. Because 8 minus 5 equals 3.
But the SOs usually don't add up like that nicely, no?
Sorry?
Usually you cannot just add the n's in SONs. No, in terms of generators, for instance. Meaning SO8,
SO8. No, but the same if you take a SO8 Majorana fermions, you gauge an SO3 charge. What's left over is a global SO5 symmetry. I mean, that's just very simple.
Yeah, I guess I don't see it as simple, but yeah, I'm not doubting what you're saying. Just don't see it in terms of counting, because the number of generators are, the number of generators of SO8 are many more than those of SO3 plus those of SO5.
Yeah, but yeah, the rank of the
engine. Yeah, well, matrix, so 3x3 here and 5x5 here.
Okay. When Subir said that the SO2 gauge theory offers an analytic approach, did he mean the epsilon expansion?
And nice way to write down the field theory. Yeah.
N is a number of fermion flavors.
But at least you could do epsilon expansion about this. Well, no, sorry, it's only
about what?
One dimension, that the direct.
You won't get a decent flank this one. Yeah. Only with the one where I expand.
Okay. So
you take this SO5 and make it very big. A number of flavors of direct fermions.
So from this you learned about the spectrum of relevant operators at this SO5 point, at this fixed point. So is this, now you can use this data to do some conformal bootstrap analysis.
Not me specifically, because I don't know how to do that, but in general, yeah, if you further constraint, I guess for bootstrap people, if you further constraint the operator content, you might be able to find this fixed point. I'm not sure.
So to be more specific, so what is the set of relevant operators that you have here in this fixed point in their SO5 charges?
Yeah, I guess you need to construct higher order tensors that somehow singlets of the SO5. I don't know exactly.
But
okay.
You only
need
one Higgs mass. Actually, here the Higgs mass is very simple. Yeah.
Yeah,
okay.
That's it.
That's a relevant operator. You don't even need to think about, you know, higher order.
But that breaks the SO5.
No, it doesn't break the SO5. The SO5 is spontaneously broken in the confining.
So the only relevant operator is an SO5 sigma.
Yes. You might be able to come up with other relevant operators, but not.
It's presumably also relevant.
Yeah, it's probably. That's why you have a job.
Right. And when you go to the structure, what's left of the C2 gauge?
But you have no. Can you estimate the scaling dimension of that?
Estimate numerically, you mean?
The Higgs mass is just given by nu.
By nu, yeah, okay.
And then you have the eta.
Well,
yeah.
I mean,
the eta is for the factor.
Yeah.
So maybe one more.
Yeah, so that's why we're defining
the confinement. You could imagine.